Welcome, everyone, to the latest podcast edition of Reimagining Mobility podcast series. I'm here with Ramesh. Ramesh, thanks for joining us. Ramesh, you have quite a bit of a history and experience in the automotive space, and also specifically as it relates to electrification and batteries. Today, I think you work in a company not directly related with mobility. So give our listeners a little bit of a background of where you're coming from, your experience when you and I first got to know one another a few years ago, and then what you're currently doing in your latest companies, and then maybe we'll jump in some hot topics in the mobility space, specifically related to batteries.
Absolutely. Stefan, Jay, thank you for having me. Appreciate it. Pleasure to be here. Yeah, so currently I'm in a company called Zenek. It's a German manufacturer for home storage systems using lithium-based batteries, but not just the battery systems, but we also do the complete ecosystem for independent, you know, grid system. So for example, we have our own solar panels, the PV systems, with which we also have our buffer batteries based on lithium-ion batteries, right? Wall box systems, so that if you have an EV, you create your own power, the excess power, you feed it back to the grid, or you can charge your car, and you can also save the excess energy so that overnight you're independent from the grid. So this is the next step, moving closer to the independency from the grid. You know, you create your own energy, so to say. And we are part of a global cloud system in a way. So what we can also do is we have a cloud-based energy account, a virtual account, with which you can store the energy back to the grid. It'll be in your account. And if you're traveling with your car, we have also a very extensive supercharging system for EVs. So you can actually be at a supercharger and you can call back the energy from your virtual account. So you are actually using your own energy virtually, so to say. So it's an interesting space. Nevertheless, the common denominator for me, as you rightly mentioned, in the last 11 years is lithium-ion batteries. I'm leading the group here. The last 11 years, I've been at the electromobility side, always something to do with traction batteries, be it pass cars or commercial vehicles. Now it's a bit different. The motivation behind it is actually seeing companies like Tesla, BYD. They have taken the rule book and tossed it in the bin, so to say. They use the battery modules for their cars, of course, you know, in upcoming trucks, as well as the storage systems. Tesla has their own, you know, container systems and home storage systems. And there's no definitive definitions between these three segments anymore, thanks to the lithium-ion technology, right? That's one of the motivations. Also, I wanted to see what the other side is like. In this case, you know, the home storage system. That's where I am now.
Very interesting. So maybe the first question before we go more into batteries, what motivated you go from, as you just mentioned, traction batteries to more sort of the home storage, the home energy, obviously the opposite end or the other side of what we're constantly talk about, the challenge of electrifying vehicles, getting the infrastructure. I think I would say you're probably more part of infrastructure now than of mobility, but what motivated you to go there? Is it technology? Is it you wanted a change in what you're looking at? Is it for the experience? Share a little bit about that.
I would say it's a bit of everything, but I think the home storage system, the market itself, it's in its baby pants, so to say. The current moment where we are today, even though we have tons of system out there, if you see the market share per se, we are exactly in the same time as Tesla were back in 2008, 2009. There are not many cars out there, comparable systems. Technology is still in early stages, so there's a lot of potential. And I do believe that with my experience in the electromobility, with all the top dogs, I can bring some of those existing synergies, which might be new for the home storage application, and make a positive difference. So that's the motivation behind it. Besides, I also wanted to see what's all the fuss about in the home storage side, right? And I must say, it's quite impressive what the home storage side can offer. And some of the cases, you're looking at a few hundred kilowatt hours of projection just by having a properly installed solar panels. And you're just making money off it because you're throwing back at the grid, which means you're actually getting back money, which is also an incentive to the customer in comparison to electromobility. Where you buy an EV car, drive it for the fun of it. Of course, it's environmentally friendly. It's fun to drive, but you're not making money off it, right? Unless and until you are an Uber driver, it's part of a fleet. But buying a home storage battery system, you have that incentive, the possibility right from the day one, anyone who buys it, right? So it also motivates the crowd as an end customer, not just have an independent energy system, rather than also have an incentive in a commercial aspect. So the market is of a different dimension. There's a different pull and push dynamic going on here. And of course, the common denominator, as I mentioned, I'm in love with lithium-ion technologies. And this market is really fierce in moving forward, you know, taking to the next step. And it's kind of underrated, if you will, right? Not many are talking about the home storage systems as much as they are talking about Teslas and semi-trucks.
Sure. Well, I agree with that. I mean, interesting point you're making about making money or at least staying level, because that was one of my dad, who lives in Europe's main motivation to put solar panels on the roof and have an energy storage in the basement, right, for exactly that. And whatever energy he doesn't use, he's selling back. And it's almost like a win-win for him. So good point. So maybe then moving to specifically your experience in traction batteries, and you mentioned that, and now home storage, but both with lithium-ion batteries. What are the different challenges between the two applications? Traction batteries, obviously, we all know it's energy density, it's weight per energy density, per range, it's thermal management. Those are some of the hot topics in the industry. Range, obviously, is not the issue in a home storage, but what are the main issues that you're experiencing now that, as you said, you bring your experience in to help now move the home storage battery market, hopefully, forward?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. So one of the challenges that I see is that it's still a green field. There are a lot of potential to grow. There are a lot of directions that this market could take into. There are very few competitors, so to say. Nevertheless, the speed at which the market is actually evolving and keep up with that speed in terms of technology, in terms of commitment, in terms of innovation is one of the key challenges, I would say. Regardless of what the automotive industry is currently doing, there are several synergies that we are taking into account. For example, we are not reinventing the wheel when it comes to BMS. It's pretty much the same logic. The BMS is doing the same job as it does in the automotive case. Maybe from a different dimension on safety, because you're talking about, you know, a battery system in your basement, right? So there are different aspects of safety that we also have to take into account. But at the same time, there are different types of synergies we can also take into account. It's about picking and choosing your battle in a very clever way in terms of innovation, in terms of choosing your right chemistry, and also the terms of lifetime. Because you're talking about investment, a car, in a sense, you could buy a car. After 3 years, you might not like it. You might resell it and buy a new car, regardless if it's an ICE application or an EV application. But if you're committing to a home storage battery system, you're looking into long term, right? And you're talking about 7, 8, maximum 10 years. So lifetime is also a considerable challenge in that case. So the choice of chemistry, the usage, the positioning, also the investment per se, what kind of dividend are you getting back? So what kind of incentive are you looking into? Combining all these into account is going to be one of the nice challenges that I will be seeing in the next couple of years, hopefully.
Interesting. Let's move on a little bit. You have talked about that in the past on some of your LinkedIn posts, and specifically want to go into one that's a big discussion and certainly has taken on in China, discussions happening in Europe and also in the U.S., which is battery swapping, right? Sort of getting away from this major challenge that we're faced with is maybe not range anymore, but how fast can I charge my vehicle, right? Less the range anxiety and more the infrastructure or the time it takes for me to get back to 80% or back to 200-300 mile range. What do you see when you are looking at now, not in the traction battery industry anymore, but again, where you're at home storage and you look back into the automotive space, what do you see the pros and cons with that solution, with the battery swapping solution that certainly we see some Chinese OEMs very much focused on, and I think others, at least in the Western world, I would say more than just looking at it yet, but haven't really announced anything major. But what do you see? Interesting in your perspective.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of swapping technology. And as you mentioned, I've posted this a couple of times in my LinkedIn account. I've been talking about this a couple of times because I come from a thermal management background. And I see what we put through the cells and the modules when we are fast charging it, be it 1.5C, 2C. And I'm pretty sure you guys know about this as well. We're torturing the cell to an extent just to get the last bit of performance out of it sometimes. And it is also the necessary between, you know, having a balance between the time-saving aspect, the comfort in a way, and at the same time also to make sure that the safety of the battery cells are given in terms of long range and longevity, also the safety itself from a product safety standpoint. And swapping kind of hits the sweet spot, in my opinion, and it's not just a theory anymore. There are companies out there like NIO, also in the EV space, they've done a million swaps, more than a couple of million swaps in on a whole. I believe in Europe, they recently crossed 20,000 swaps. So the fleet is still small, but they've done a considerably great job in actually making and showing people that swapping is great. I was very fortunate to take one for a test drive, and I was able to swap one. It was less than 90 seconds, believe it or not. So I went in with a 27% battery. I came out with a 95% battery, just like that. So, and you don't have to leave the car, right? You just drive into that compartment, you sit there, you listen to your music, whatever, and then voila, you can get out with your full battery, which is amazing. And this is happening in other dimensions already. So in markets like India, China, two-wheeler segments are already using a very common base battery. So a denominator of a size in terms of voltage, energy density, C rates, mostly passively cooled. So they just put it in a swapping station, take one more out, plug it in, and voila, we can get there. The advantages are huge. Of course, there are a few downsides as well, but let's start with the advantages. First and foremost is you're being very kind to the cell, which means you don't have to overkill with the extremely high-profile thermal management design with absolutely out-of-the-world, you know, new innovation when it comes to cooling. Because most of the time, you want to pre-cool your system because you're going to fast charge, you're going to pump in as much current into the system, right? So that is a big deal, which means the design itself gets much more friendlier. And the second thing is you're being kind to the grid itself, because if you're going to charge 1,500 batteries at the same time, a considerable amount of effort needs to be taken into account because you're taking that amount of energy back from the grid. But if you have a slower charging kind of an inventory of swappable batteries, which are being slowly charged overnight, off peak hours, maybe even using the extra energies that, you know, us from home storage system giving back to the grid, you can, you know, time all these things into consideration. So your battery itself is much more preserved from a technical standpoint. The cells are being very slowly aged because most of the aging comes from fast charging per se. And the comfort part, you're still not having any kind of compromise from a comfort standpoint. Actually, it's much more comfortable to sit in your car, especially when it's cold outside, it's raining, or it's too sunny. You can just drive into that zone, 90 seconds, 95 seconds, you're out with a fully charged battery system. So that is, in my opinion, is the way to go. But of course, there are, as any system, there are downsides. The downsides being you need to have a design which supports swappable systems. It's not everyone's cup of tea. It's obviously easier in terms of IP rating, in terms of longevity, mating cycles between the contactors. An easier part, the load rest take, is in this case, the swappable system. I definitely see some of the legacy makers at least try this, because once they see companies like NIO and some other Chinese manufacturers actually showing that this actually works really well, and the customers are actually happy with it, then maybe some of the legacy makers will actually be tempted to see, okay, then maybe we can test a small fleet of comparable battery systems and see if it's swappable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So while you're talking, an idea comes to mind, and I'm going to run it past you. For the U.S., we're probably, you know, not as we've seen in NIO's case, right? Large cities in China have gotten, and we see it in Europe, I think, is more in inner cities as well, for obvious reasons. Much more higher usage of those swapping stations than when outside of cities. The U.S., which is much more widespread maybe and hopes to have a more widespread application of EVs, is in your opinion, would it make sense for OEMs in the U.S. to maybe work together with, I don't know, a McDonald's, a Burger King who has those drive-thrus to make those swapping stations as part of you going through the drive-thru? As you said, you're sitting in the car, you can eat a snack, you get changed, maybe we'll work together with a fast food chain or whatever to kind of combine the real estate, investment and benefits to the consumer.
Absolutely. That makes absolute sense, especially if you put comfort in the front, in the forefront, which is one of the most important criteria for a customer, then this actually speaks for it. And besides, even in the remote areas, let's take an example, maybe in the middle of nowhere in Phoenix, Arizona, maybe in Texas, where you have a lot of sunshine, you can actually have an independent charging system with carports buckled up with all the solar panels that you can get your hands on. Because A, we have a landscape to do that, and B, it's middle of nowhere, we can also justify the cost. And if you're actually having customers wanting to use it, maybe with a McDonald's or maybe with a Burger King chain attached to it, they're going to make that stop. It's going to be strategically positioned in such a way that, okay, after 250 miles of drive, a customer needs a bio break. They might need to have some drink. And the system is actually equipped with a certain size of batteries that needs to be in the reserve, in the inventory, which means you can actually make that happen. And it doesn't have to be a perfectly well-executed plan in the first run. It could be a trial and error. So maybe we can start with a 1.5 times amount of batteries being put into the basement, which is swappable, and see if it's too big, too small. The space is certainly not an issue in the United States as it is in Europe or in China, where congestion is an issue, real estate is an issue, right? In the United States, there's ample amount of space. So be it as it may, we can actually block a huge space, try it with a small fleet size, see if the customers are receiving it better. If yes, slowly, you know, use the existing space by which you can also tap into the solar energy, the wind energy that is nearby. Of course, you do need certain level of grid support, but the whole point is you don't need that speed which you're taking the energy away from the grid. It could be much more of a soft way of actually getting back the energy, be it wind energy, solar energy, whatever energy that you can get your hands on. You don't need that massive chunk of energy at stretch. And now we are talking about Tesla's coming in with their semis, all the commercial trucks, and we are talking about megawatt of energies, you know, taking away from the grid. And I'm pretty sure the grid will handle in the near future, because back in 2008, the grid was never this strong as we have today. And if you think about the curve, how this have developed in the last couple of years, it's amazing. So I have no doubt that the megawatt charge will also work. But maybe it's a healthy alternative having a pre-charged battery system just lying around waiting for the next truck to pass by. The truck drivers, they take a bio break, maybe a couple of hours. So they are not in a hurry, have 90 seconds. Maybe they are okay with an hour. And that hour, you're being a kind to the cell, where the truck industry is much more commercially driven. They are much more cost sensitive. So you're not pumping that energy back from the grid, where there are also certain losses involved, rather than you're swapping the batteries and the battery also having a bit of longer life. I think there is certainly a possibility, much more of a possibility in the United States, because the United States is still early stages of implementing it. So you guys have still the opportunity and luxury to choose one way or another and try out before going for the absolute last option for it.
Yeah, interesting. So maybe then let's assume for a moment this is the current challenge and these are some solutions. What if then people say, yeah, okay, but you know, we're already going to LFP-based battery chemistries, LMFP battery-based chemistries that supposedly are much better off charging and discharging at faster speed, hopefully sooner rather than later, right? Everybody wants to the latest holy grail, which is solid-state batteries. Ramesh, are we still then going to have, in your opinion, those same challenges that we're really punishing the batteries for our convenience, meaning we want to charge them fast, we want to get going again and don't want to wait 1 or 2 hours to charge? Or is it then going to change with new technologies coming up for batteries?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I've also been, you know, seeing this from a neutral perspective. Of course, from a battery side, I would definitely wish the swapping systems there, but also have to be commercially viable, right? So at the end of the day, if it's not commercially viable, no matter how good the technology is, it's not going to fly. That's a fact. But also with having all the new technologies, the ones that you mentioned, the LMFPs, the new sodium-ion batteries, there is always going to be a certain level of degradation on the charging side. And this degradation is also considerably higher when you're pumping in higher energies. So there's always going to be an efficiency loss. Now the efficiency loss in terms of kilowatt hours that is being lost on the complete fleet when you're charging may be marginal. But imagine we have a substantially higher fleet of commercial batteries, of EV sectors, fast cars, and also two-wheelers, micro-mobility. And if you add that all up, at one point of time, there will be a number which would be massive just because of the efficiency loss of pumping in the battery power during charging. And then you have to ask the question, how are we getting this energy? Do we have that much excess energy for us to justify this? Or is this something that is commercially acceptable because we are baked into the existing commercial models? Or is swappable systems still a way to go? Because as you mentioned early in the call, markets like China, India, even Philippines, they're trying to embrace the swappable system because A, they don't have the luxury, even though they have tons of renewable energies as today, they don't have the luxury of having that amount of loss because they have a huge market to address. They want to get their hands into as many parallel technologies as possible. And at one point of time in the future, you have all the data that is required from each of these technology streams so that you can make a technology-based, data-driven decision. So if someone from the parliament were to ask you a question, why did we as a country, why did we as a company make this decision? You can show these are the numbers from swappable systems. These are the numbers from charging with new chemistries. And these are the numbers from the future solid-state systems, which might be the holy grail from the past car applications. So I believe that is really important because now we are still in the theoretical side in most of the cases, especially if you take each and individual continents as an isolated islands. And I wish that we have a bit more clarity in terms of data before we actually pull that trigger.
I agree. And I think maybe the other piece too is, right, to your point, if we don't, let's call it, destroy faster or make our batteries faster or degrade them faster, then maybe we also help a little bit with our recycling problem. That certainly is a much bigger topic, not issue, but topic in Europe, starting to come in the U.S. I haven't seen it much in Asia per se, but we know it's going to come. But with that also is we probably then use our resource much longer than swapping it over and over again or replacing it over and over again. So maybe a couple of last questions before we end here. In your opinion, Ramesh, what's the one thing, one or two things that the automotive traction battery guys could learn from the stationary battery guys, now that you're in there? Is there something that your new industry is really doing different in your opinion better than maybe what we in the mobility space are doing when it comes to batteries? Anything charging, design, thermal management, whatever it might be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are always things to learn. One of the things that I see as an opportunity for the mobility sector to learn from the home storage system is the communication to grid. Now, we are already talking about vehicle to grid, the vehicle itself being part of your home storage application, but we are still early stages, right? There are very few cars can support it, and the software that can support is also very landlocked, it's region-locked. And that is one of the important things. So the customer can incentivize the product buying decision. So if you buy a car, it could be used as your storage application overnight, just like the F-150 Lightning. But also you can throw that energy which you have in excess to the grid as your virtual power plant. The VPP as an abbreviation is being thrown around in Europe much more and much more frequently than in the United States. And that is mostly because in the United States, I think the option of having the car as your backup energy is still in early stages, right? You have your F-150 coming in. I'm pretty sure there are a lot of other cars coming out with same technology, but I think the cloud-based application of virtual power plant is going to be a game changer. And I would wish that the legacy automakers and also the new guys take that into account, because at one point of time, homeowners who are also going to be an EV owner going to absolutely enjoy having that option between those two products.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was, when you mentioned that earlier, I thought that was a very interesting concept. Again, using the cloud, using sort of what we do with emissions credits as well, right? Between OEMs and other stuff is very interesting. So maybe then the last question, now that you've been gone from the automotive or mobility space for some time, if you're looking back, what's the one or two things you wish we would have done differently? Again, not necessarily lessons learned, as we just said, but when you're looking back, what are one or two things that you wish, man, you know, I wish either the mobility space would understand this better, or we would have taken a different approach. Again, maybe more swapping focused and charging. But what are some of the things you've taken away, you walked away and you look back, it's like, I wish they would have or we would have.
There are a couple of things, but off the top of my head, there are two things which I wish the mobility sector had done it sooner. They're doing it now, but I wish like 6-7 years earlier. The one thing is increasing the voltage to a level that we can, you know, reduce the current, keep the same performance, both charging and discharging. The company decisions sometimes where there's not many suppliers, there's not many technologies out there which are state of the art. So let's play it safe. Let's be in the 400 volt region, where I see a potential. Looking back, we could have done 800 volt plus 7-8 years back had we had, you know, all hands on deck, you know, all the legacy makers coming together and say, let's push the supply base to have supplying components for 800 plus volt. And if you look in the market today, there's one car with lesser energy but higher voltage can do 500 plus miles. That's Lucid Air, right? It has 115 kilowatt hours. The one reason is they have 900 plus volt. And if you compare that to the other competitions with mostly 400 volts, the difference is very obvious. Even the end customers can see it, right? And I wish the legacy automakers and automobile manufacturers saw that earlier and kind of made that push, be brave and, you know, take that leap to the next stage. That was one. The second one is also to play around with some of the chemistries. I mean, we see Tesla doing it time and again because they're not bound by the rules of an automotive, a traditional automobile manufacturer. They can do things because they're not automotive, you know, driven. I wish the traditional automakers, they came together. We see it today and yesterday. I think we saw the GM announcing that they're going to tie up with Tesla's interface. I wish we had done this earlier. Come together, make sure we design a certain chemistry. It's not for the profit of the company itself, but profit of the market. This way, the push that we have in the market is much severe in a positive way. And the customers are much more benefited because imagine you driving a Mach-E today or a Corvette and you get access to the Tesla supercharger. That's the holy grail there. You get to drive a car which is other than Tesla, which has, you know, buttons and whatnot that you really like, but you still have the reliability of driving through a Tesla supercharger. Just plug it in, no QR code, no taking off your app and typing in things, credit card, whatever. That is the best of both worlds. And we should have had this idea a few years back rather than have this competitive landscape where we bring in the Mustang, we bring in the Corvette, we bring in the Dodge Challenger, which was the traditional thought process. I wish we had this thought a few years, half a decade earlier, in which case the EV market would have been much further down the lane than it is today, but we're getting there.
Right. So the adoption would have been faster. Instead of working against one another, we would have collaborated. And again, as you mentioned, the user interface, the simplicity of it all helps with EV adoption in the end.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
So, okay, then maybe one last question, and it should be a simple one. At least you give me your idea. You said, again, OEMs are now finally more maybe, I mean, we see it too from the ABL side, obviously being in the business, to the 800 plus volt system. My question sometimes is, where does it end? Are we going to go? We've talked about already 1200 volt systems for more heavy duty applications. Where do you see the end? Because in the e-motors, right? I mean, 5 years ago, we looked at, 15,000, that's the max. Then we saw 25,000, and now we have an e-axle that goes up to 30,000 RPM, and we see e-motors that are even higher than that. So I've asked some of the experts on that side, right? Where do they see the end? Because it's not 100,000, probably, it's not bigger and bigger every day, right? Or every year, right? From a battery voltage, where do you see the sort of the, let's call it the holy grail again, as we talked before, with solid state batteries?
This is going to change, I think, drastically. It's an excellent question. 1,000 volts, if you were to ask me 10 years ago when I was at BMW, I would have said no way in 10 years. We are way too fast, but fast forward 10 years, Tesla Semi, Cybertruck are going to come out with 1,000 volt architecture. There are a few very small space of truck manufacturers also pushing that limit of 1,000 volt systems. And there are also, if you take the synergies, the tram networks that we have currently today, if I'm not quoting it wrong, they're already operating between 1,500 and 3,000 volts. So the technology is there. Of course, it's not the same application, but you know the voltage system, the architecture, the voltage ranges are already given. So I believe somewhere between 1,500 to 1,800 might be the future, the near-term future, the next 5-6 years. But I would not be surprised if you're reaching out to 3,000 volts in the near future, be it the next 10 years, 15 years. It's a matter of question. Because the higher the voltage, of course, the lesser the losses, as you know. So So the lesser the losses, it also means at the end of the day, efficiency. I believe to sum it off, EV has given for the very first time in a long, long time, the thought of efficiency also for the end customers. How efficient am I driving? How efficient is the charging? Am I paying for the kilowatt hours that I'm paying, right? This also would mean at one point of time, the customers will be so far ahead that they would say, why not just increase the voltage and just reduce the current losses? And that is going to happen sooner than later, which means the manufacturers are in dire need to think outside the box and pushing the voltage. That would be my opinion.
Okay. Thank you, Ramesh. I appreciate it. And thanks for tuning in to Reimagining Mobility Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Reimagine Mobility Podcast. If you like this episode, please subscribe and tell a friend.